There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Oh, hello. It's Wednesday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints, where the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's been inspiring and provoking us lately. Gather around the table this Wednesday, we've got Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
And Danielle Riendo.
Hi, hello.
Austin is out on vacation that isn't really a vacation, and Natalie is down with the autumn plague, soon to be followed by the winter plagues.
Yep.
Get your flu shot.
Get him.
Don't think that's what's troubling Natalie, but nevertheless, flu shot's always good. Good for other people, too. Anyway, so, you know, for the last couple months, I think it's been Danielle who's been really excited about how positive and supportive Instagram is compared to, like, Twitter and other social media.
It's true. It's 100% the case.
Patrick, it looks like your waypoint this week is all about explaining to Danielle about why she's wrong and Instagram is bad, actually.
Well, folks that are aware of the Waypoint podcast canon know that Danielle and I are now married. And so this is now part of this dynamic is you got to start tearing that white. You know, you got to put them in check every once in a while. And this is just one of those things. So
it's that classic Sam and Diane podcast dynamic.
Classic.
Sam and Diane were a famous couple in sitcom history, kids, if you didn't know that. You can watch Cheers on Netflix. Anyway.
We're all in our 30s. It's fine.
I think you can.
So there is a piece by Taylor Lorenz, who is a great Twitter follow. If you are like me and that you are interested in internet culture, especially on social networks, especially on YouTube, but don't have the time to kind of delve into that stuff yourself, like I certainly Waypoint has talked about things. You know, we talk about PewDiePie, like we talk about JonTron. Like there are times where we get into that culture, but it's always like very specific to games and sort of on a case by case basis. And Taylor Lorenz is just a terrific reporter who does deep dives into this stuff in a way that I find to be like very accessible. So that's just an aside for just kind of following this person's work outside of this piece, which I ran in the Atlantic. It's called Instagram Has a Massive Harassment Problem, and it basically walks through the narrative that is presented by Instagram is that they are the nice social network. It is where you go to feel good about yourself. They do all sorts of like promotional events that are about like sexual and body positivity and like anti-bullying and all sort of, and these sorts of things are outlined in the piece. And if you read any sort of the fluffy profiles of Instagram and their approach to with how they want their social network to be, that is very much core to their at least PR ethos. And what this piece does is sort of breaks down, well, what is actually happening on the ground? What is actually happening to users? And what Taylor, this is something that's been discussed before, but what I found provocative about Taylor's piece is the way she pulls all of the threads together to sort of dismantle Instagram's own narrative. Because I, like Danielle, really like Instagram has sort of become my day-to-day social network. Like the hierarchy for me, and I'd be curious how the rest of you shakes out for everyone else, is like Twitter is something I engage with largely in a professional capacity because I find stories there, I communicate with an audience there. It is critical to the success, like the page view success of my stories often is to be on Twitter. And so Twitter has less become a personal outlet as much as a professional outlet. And, you know, we could do a whole separate podcast about how all that stuff intermingles, but that is kind of where it sits in terms of how I view Twitter. I don't have a private Twitter, which I know is very common for a lot of people to, so they can kind of like turn Twitter into a smaller, more personal platform. And then it's Instagram, which I transitioned to largely because that's where I saw all my friends going to, like the emergence of Instagram stories, in which people could take like short video and text clips and like share those in a, I think it's 12 or 13 seconds is roughly what you can share on an Instagram story. That just took over all like my 30 something and a late 20 something friends. They shifted from Facebook to Instagram. And so if I wanted to interact with those people, like I found like interactions dropping on Facebook, but interactions skyrocketing on Instagram. So I moved over there. And I also have a private account, which is where like I share things about my family and stuff like that. And then Facebook is for my extended family members, traditionally like 40 and above, who it is just a Jessica Rose Klumpik repository for photos. I could text those to them. I could email them to them. In my heart of hearts, I know I will not do that. And so Facebook is just a place to share photos of my daughter so that my extended family can see her when they don't, you know, when it's not holidays and things like that. So that's where I fall on this piece, on my social networks. And Daniel, given the way that I know, like, you used Instagram, but you have kind of vocalized a, like, newfound enjoyment of the positivity and community of Instagram. So I'm curious how reading a piece like this, what your experience has been like, and how that transition has kind of taken place.
Yeah, I feel very much like, well, so I've had Instagram since 2013, I think. I've had an account and, you know, posted every now and then, kind of. I think there were, like, years in between. But a few months ago, sort of refound it as a very happy, positive platform for me, because that's where all my training partners are. All my jock friends are on Instagram. They're on Facebook as well, and that's where I connect with some of them, and that's where like some of my like my queer grappling group that is primarily on Instagram and Facebook. So like I use both of them for those kinds of things. But like, yeah, all my sporty friends, they're not on Twitter. They're definitely on Instagram and Facebook. So I started with that and being like, oh, I should connect with all these people. I should, you know, like I should connect with them online because I see them in person, you know, if we're going to train a particular day, if we want to talk about that sort of thing. And then just fell in completely because I do like the platform, but that was not to say that I think it's perfect. And obviously this piece goes into a whole bunch of reasons why that is true. So it's one of those things where it's like, I don't deny anything in this piece. This piece is beautifully put together. The fact that I've had good experiences on the platform does not negate horrible experiences, and especially the way that it has been used by teens. You know, I know that portion of it is really kind of telling and really kind of scary.
It's horrifying.
Yeah, it's really messed up. There's also the fact that like Instagram has become something of a dating platform for queer women. There's like a special subset of like dating things you can do.
Are those like hashtags? Like what are, I don't want to like give away the game.
No, it's fine. There's a personal ad service specifically for queer women and like femmes and non-binary and femme identified. Like it's a very inclusive definition for, you know, women, non-binary and femme identified folks who want to date each other. And you can actually like put out a personal ad and like other people will see that and it's attached to your profile. So it's much more awesome than like traditional dating services where you have a profile that you've cultivated for just dating. Instead, it's like, oh, this is your Instagram profile, which of course you've cultivated to some degree, but it might not be as like as constructed just for dating the way that people will make a profile just for dating. That is like
the hierarchy
the hierarchy of
you're like all social networks are like a version of yourself that you want to present, and it sounds like your version of Instagram or where you've got it now is one where it's like it runs that line of like it is your true self in so much as any of these social networks are a curated reflection of our true self.
Exactly. But again, just because I've had positive experiences does not negate the fact that there are issues with this platform.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really scary about this is it very much seems like an Eye of Sauron type thing where like if the crowd never really latches on to like fucking up your social media shit, you'll be fine. Like Instagram seems like it'll be a cool, fun platform to hang out on. But it seems totally unable to handle the fact that, like, there is a ton of brigading that happens, particularly of, like, women with any kind of profile, or even not, like, you know, just women who like comment on the wrong post that day. You know, the mob decides to come after them. And then there is the other aspect of like, this is the new cruelty for high schoolers to an extent as well. And neither
it goes younger than that. Like I've heard from family members, like it starts as soon as you make the mistake of like giving your kid access to like an old phone or an iPad. Oh, and so as young as middle school is where like this stuff kicks off. And like, this is like, let me read this quick passage, which is with how the article opens, to kind of give a sense of like what Rob is alluding to here. So I'm quoting from Taylor's piece. When Brandon Farbstein first joined Instagram in 2014, he was 14 and optimistic. Farbstein was born with a rare form of dwarfism, and he wanted to use the photo sharing site to educate people about his condition, to, as he told me, quote, show people a glimpse into my life and inspire people. Soon enough, though, the hateful messages started coming. Death threats, expletive-laden comments about his appearance, worse. A meme page put his face on Hitler's body. Multiple accounts popped up with the explicit purpose of taunting him. His house was swatted. When he does a live video, the insults float on screen fast and furious. Quote, it's been hard to keep my composure, Farbstein told me. After trolls started posting pictures of him in the hallways at his high school, he started to fear for his safety. Eventually, he left and finished high school online. Quote, my entire experience of high school was completely ruined by Instagram harassment, he said. It's draining. It's anxiety producing. I'm used to people calling me names, but it's when people say that they're going to kill me or come find my family that really gets me in a sense of pure terror. Really, nothing can prevent or get in the way of that taking over your thoughts and emotions. And so, like, this isn't just like random internet bullies. Like, I think a lot of times we talk about harassment. It is targeted, it is terrible, it is traumatic, but often it is this it's this viral mob, right? It's the Eye of Sauron. It's you're an SJW. You said something about James Gunn or whatever. Like, there is something like that. Things just get pointed your way, and certainly that happens on like a micro level and amongst like school communities and in high school and middle school. But that stuff is so not that. Just remembering what it was like to be in middle school and high school and how you felt. Like, yes, people were often mean and cruel, but what social networking has done is made the ability to do that, especially in public ways, so fucking easy.
Yeah.
Like, not that it wasn't easy before, but this is a tap of a finger. It is thoughtless to a degree that clearly none of these social networks thought about the consequences of what you put this in the hands of just like ruthless, mean kids, of which many of us probably participated in, you know, unknowingly, because kids are often just fucking cruel.
Yeah, and I think on the other hand, though, we are so far past where, like, nobody could have foreseen that this was happening to check out.
It's knowing ignorance, yeah.
The passage that really leaped out for me, and this dovetails with the piece we discussed last week about Facebook, because basically these are the same company, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this
owned by the same company.
Yeah. But there's a passage here where they describe the moderation teams. According to an Instagram spokesperson, Facebook and Instagram share a team of 20,000 people working on safety and security across both platforms. Of that team, 7,500 people, a mix of contractors, full-time employees, and staff from partner companies, are tasked with reviewing content for the more than 1 billion people who use Instagram and 2 billion who use Facebook every month around the world. That is effectively not moderated at all. Yeah. Like, for that scale, like, effectively what you've decided is, you know, you're looking at a massive, like, jagged iceberg hole in the hull, and you've like put some like a strip of duct tape over one part of it. That's basically what you're doing here. And even there, by the way, I love the partner companies, which I think we all pretty much know like how that deal's probably structured. In terms of
and those are probably the I think there was a piece in the New Yorker, this and Motherboard, I believe, did a piece here this year about like these different companies that are often contract workers that are tasked with moderating, you know, the worst parts of humanity. Go read some of those articles if you want to
I read that story 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Talking about people who tried to moderate YouTube, and like there's like teams within Google of like contractors who is like, all right, you need to watch all these like sketchy YouTube videos to make sure that like none of them are bad before we like put them out to the public. And it was a lot of bad shit, and people saw a lot of like traumatizing things. But it's just deeply, there's I think two really frustrating things here. One is that like, the human nature problem of just the shitty behavior that social media sort of allows and exacerbates. But then there's the other problem of the sort of willful naivete we see about this problem consistently, this constant like bumblefuck response to an old and ongoing phenomenon of like, well, gee, I just couldn't have anticipated this volume of, you know, bad activity. New York Times Day is running a story about how Facebook still isn't really grappling with the fact that, like, literally in the Myanmar genocide of the Rohingya, literally, like, Facebook was, like, used as a weapon. It was part of the, like, military campaign of ethnic cleansing. It was a tool. It was coordinated. And it was coordinated using, like, basic, like, manipulation of Facebook tactics. That entire crisis maybe doesn't happen or doesn't happen the same way if Facebook operates differently, responsibly, or with a modicum of effective moderation.
Or any accountability, right?
Yeah, but instead it's this constant like, well, it's a big world out there and we're just one company.
Well, and then, you know, you have, you know, one of the rare times in which, you know, these powerful people come before, you know, the U.S. Senate, like there were these hearings recently, like Mark Zuckerberg came out of his replacing the pieces of his body. And like one of the Orrin Hatch, who is a disgusting garbage piece of shit for all sorts of reasons other than this question, but asked like, but how do you make any money? And like Mark, like Zuckerberg responds, you know, saying like, well, we run ads, Senator. And it's like, that's such a microcosm of like the macro problem, which is that these are nation states that have monetized like some of our worst tendencies, created addictive psychological feedback loops in which there's no democratic process to change them in twofold. One, because they are powerful corporations who are protected by the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Like there's shade on both sides. But the people in power are old, tend to be white, have no idea what these services do, and are in no position to actually enact meaningful change to try and curb some of these issues. Like consequences could be laid out for the lack of foresight or the feigned ignorance from these companies, but there's reason to despair because what are you supposed to do? And then compounding that, the best possible way to get your message out is using the fucking platforms.
Yep.
Is tweeting at Jack or whatever to be like, this is fucking bad. Like that is a horrifying loop to be stuck in. There are lots of reasons I'm scared for the future of my child, but this shit scares the hell out of me. Cause like, I know how hard it can be to be in school. I was lucky that it wasn't as rough for me as I know it was for so many other people, but it can be. And it's just the ease at which you can ruin lives now. And the way that social identities are important growing up. And now that we've latched these to digital platforms in which all sorts of harassment and malignment can happen at the drop of a hat, like just, it's so easy to imagine how you can be ostracized for things that are wildly outside of your control because the gang mentality when you're young is like so primal. Like you want to be part of the popular tribe and just, it scares the shit out of me. Like I used to be happy that I missed the boat on dating online because that sounds like it's a nightmare. I mean, it sounds like it's never been easier to hook up, but it's never been harder to actually get in a relationship is like my takeaway from all my friends that do it. But then now since I've had a kid and I started thinking more, you know, logical conclusions to all this stuff on how it affects, you know, really, really young people. It's just, it's terrifying. I don't see where this gets better. I only see where this gets worse and more personalized and more targeted. It's just, I don't know where we come out on the other side in this stuff.
Yeah. How do we evolve? How do we evolve from this and deal with it?
So I guess for me, like I tend to look at this stuff as I like to think we can evolve and like norms can change. So we've somehow adapted and psychologically accommodate the information age, the internet. But I also think there's just a strong case to be made, like in terms of things you can advocate now and like push politicians to do. Like, there's a strong antitrust case against like what Facebook has turned into, yeah. Right? Like, Facebook acquired Instagram back in 2012. It was a somewhat controversial acquisition back then, because there already were sort of antitrust concerns.
They own WhatsApp since then.
Yeah.
Yep. WhatsApp is like the people don't really think about WhatsApp because it's not very popular in the US, but it is like the predominant communication platform internationally. Like Facebook, like their tentacles are just fucking everywhere. And yeah, at the very least, if you were to split those companies apart, that would be, would it solve all this? No. But would it like create more accountability because it's spread across distributed platforms? Like, yes, like that's, those are meaningful steps in the right direction. So we'll see. You know, I'm curious, you know, we got the midterms coming up. 2020 is coming up. We're already watching potential candidates really fuck up their opening gambits into becoming 2020 candidates, which is not my waypoint, but I thought about it for a little bit. And I'm curious how things like this, like, I think there is going to be a strong, in the Democratic primary, a strong anti-corporate, push. And I'm hopeful that maybe this will become one of the legs of that anti-corporate push, is to think through stuff like this and to think about these questions, because they are going to be only more predominant and impactful in the years ahead. And so if we're going to start busting up companies, you know, I think starting with the social networks in Silicon Valley is a hell of a place to start.
Yeah, I agree. I also want to know a little bit more about, like, if you're a parent and your child is experiencing bullying, or if you are just a person in the world and you're experiencing this sort of harassment, like, if are there good resources for people? Do we even have that at this point? Are there?
From teachers that are in my life, no.
Wow. Yeah.
Like think of how undervalued and how underfunded teachers are on the basic stuff, and then try to imagine what the resources are for things like social networks. There have been different ways I've heard over the years. Like, it used to be the case that, and this is community by community, district by district, school by school, but like, and I think this might have been tried legally, and I'm not sure how it shook out, but that like, if you, like, lots of schools have internal wireless now, and so it's like, if harassment occurs on the school's wireless, then it is, like, basically what schools are grappling with is, like, when harassment occurs on a social media platform, yes, that occurred in the hallway, but it didn't occur in the hallway. And so different schools have tried to approach that, where if they get alerted to a form of harassment or bullying or abuse, if you were on the school's Wi-Fi, that is then school, like, under school jurisdiction. And so there are versions of that, but it's so early days and it's already so bad. And my guess is you're only getting thoughtfulness like that in schools that are, like, extremely well-funded, that have the extra money to even consider it.
Yeah, yeah. Man.
But, you know, speaking of things that happened back in 2012 that are surprisingly impactful today. So this last week, of all things, and I don't fully know why or how. Like, so, okay, I still have a Netflix DVD queue. Because...
Wait, hold on. What? You're one of those,
like,
people?
I like Blu-rays. And so,
I love Blu-rays,
like,
too.
If I really want to see a movie, like the right way, right? Like, if I really give a shit about, like, shot composition and just what that movie's going to look like, I'm going to try to get it on Blu-ray through Netflix, so that you don't get, like, because you can see the places, like, where a stream is compressing, right? Like, in dark, like, fuzzy,
especially Netflix. Like, iTunes is pretty good, but yeah, like Netflix and Hulu. Yeah, if you're those blacks, if you want those to look right, you're going to want that on a disc.
So I still have this huge DVD queue, and because it's like serious cinema, I go through it very slowly because it's entirely aspirational.
Can you even manage this on the app, or do you have to do this on the
website?
You
gotta do it on the website, man. You gotta, like, it's still, good. Like,
It's a separate subscription, right? It's not, like, all bundled together. Like, you pay for
it. It basically is, but yeah, it's done now. It's DVD.com, I think, is how they run it.
Because
there was
God.
That entire Quickster debacle ages ago.
Yes.
Shout out to Chris Remo. So... Anyway, though, so
sorry,
this thing
anyway.
Has just been hanging out on my DVD queue for ages. So Looper is a 2012 movie from Rian Johnson. And obviously Rian Johnson, notable now for being a major director of the Star Wars films. I think he's booked for three more.
And that was before he did, that was before the Breaking Bad finale, right? He did the penultimate episode, not the finale.
Yeah, but it was a couple years before, I think.
He did Ozymandias,
2014?
Right?
Yes, maybe? Yeah, which is it's such an amazing episode of television.
So The interesting thing about Looper is I remember, because I saw it ages ago, like on a red-eye flight back to Boston from like LA or San Francisco.
And that's actually kind of perfect, to be honest, but yeah.
Yeah, and it didn't make too much of an impression on me, because at that point, what I was really expecting was a high-concept sci-fi movie in a lot of ways, because like the conceit of this movie is Joseph Gordon-Levitt plays what's called a Looper, which is basically a time-traveling hitman, except the hitman doesn't time travel. You just send people you want killed back in time to where the Looper is standing there with a shitty little shotgun. The Looper kills whoever you want killed in the past, stashes the body. As far as the past is concerned, the murder hasn't happened because this guy doesn't exist yet, so who gives a shit? And that's kind of the conceit of the movie. And he, every Looper eventually, to sort of tie off the knot, eventually will execute themselves. They're older versions. You close your loop, and then you get 30 years to go spend your criminal fortune, and then someday they come collect you and send you back in time to shoot yourself. It sounds harder to follow than it really is. It makes perfect sense in the movie. But when I first saw that movie, I really thought that the movie was about like time travel. In a lot of ways, it was about this whole world they built where, like, in the future, criminals are the only ones who control time travel, and they use it to sort of manipulate the past, mostly to dump bodies. And I think what dawned on me this time as I watched it is the degree to which it's yet another Rian Johnson crime movie more than it's a sci-fi movie. Like, it reminded me a lot. Like, when I first saw Looper, I was like, boy, I don't see how the guy who made Brick, which is a Joseph Gordon-Levitt like noir murder mystery that is set entirely in a high school, and everyone is a high school student, but everyone is also like a cop, a nightclub owner, you know, private eye. I didn't understand like how Looper was from the same director, but the second time watching it, I was really struck by like just the ways it really reminded me of like an Elmore Leonard movie. Really is. It's much more of a darkly funny movie about criminals than it is a sci-fi movie, I think. At least that was my sort of read on it. Really sort of caught me off guard how much I enjoyed it this time.
I did not do a refresh watch. I would have, I promise, if I wasn't obsessed with my own waypoint. But I did watch it maybe 2 years ago or so. So I did relatively fresh, at least fresher than some of the stuff we talk about here. And I remember liking it as a movie, but not fully enjoying it, actually. It was one of those for me. Like, I appreciated it, and I appreciated what it was doing and where it was working on sort of various levels. Like, it does have a pretty classic time travel structure and a pretty classic time travel kind of ending. Like, oh, okay. It's obviously all about closing the loop. It's all about sort of preventing this monster from being created or being created sort of completely, right? I'm remembering that correctly.
Yeah.
Yes? Okay. And on that level, I found it somewhat rote, I suppose. But on that other level, on that sort of aesthetic level that you're talking about, I do find it a fascinating movie. I do like the sort of elements of sci-fi and also almost like a noirish Western vibe to a lot of it, especially a lot of the shots, obviously, in the house and the sort of the fields.
His apartment.
And sort of the apartment. Yeah, a lot of the color usage and a lot of the sort of the way things are framed is very, very, very interesting. So I you know, clearly do need a secondary sort of refresh watch. But I think it does work on several levels, but I think I went in, again, with that expectation of, like, this is going to be a sci-fi-ass sci-fi movie, and didn't get that, and was somewhat disappointed, sort of, at the time, a couple of years ago. But I am tempted. I am very tempted to appreciate it more on the sort of aesthetic level.
Well, I remember this movie, I remember liking it, but I remember watching it, unfortunately, like, there's, like a certain window you can watch, like, a deeply praised, like, the response to this movie initially was hyperbolic. Mm-hmm. Like, Yeah. Looper's one of the greatest sci-fi films ever made. You know, Rian Johnson's going to go on to be blah, blah, blah. I mean, he very well be. I think Rian Johnson's a terrific filmmaker, and I'm excited to see the things he does in the future and the things he's done in the past. I think have been terrific as well. But this was like my first real I had heard of Brick, had not seen it. Still haven't seen it for whatever reason. That's like certainly on my list of movies I need to like rectify.
Yeah, Brick is genius.
But that's what I've heard. It's like remains probably his best work so far. But the reaction to Looper, and especially as someone like everyone in this group, everyone at White Point probably, like, you know, deep into an appreciation of science fiction, especially like sort of like high concept science fiction. I liked it, but I remember thinking like, oh, okay. That was good. And I wonder now if it's been long enough that like so much of that has faded that you can go back to just appreciating what it is as opposed to what you think it's supposed to be. And like that's such a difficult thing, especially I find this so much more challenging these days, given just how much, on it, frankly, like great media we are exposed to on all sorts of different formats, that it's just so much harder to find yourself, for lack of a better word, like in the right loop, like in that bubble where it's like you can critically appreciate it because you've seen people being like, hey, this is something you would enjoy, but without that bubble getting like so expansive that your expectations become like you end up having an opposite reaction because of what you were like, Danielle, you talked about A Quiet Place. Like, I think that happened to that movie.
Yeah.
Like, I was encouraging people, you need to go see it now because, like, I saw it opening night and I was like, people are going to flip for this movie in a way that is going to be disproportionate to how good it is. It's like, I liked this movie a lot, especially on like a thriller level, on a scare level. But oh no, like people haven't seen a movie like this in a while, done this well and effectively. Like you need to go see it now before you think it's one of the greatest movies of all time,
yep.
Which it is not. And I think I'm curious to revisit Looper now because it has none of that baggage. I think it just settled into being like a good movie, maybe a slightly above average Rian Johnson movie because of like his pedigree and the other things he's done, especially in television since then. But I was just in a weird space where I don't think I saw it in the theater. I saw it when it came out to rent. And I probably got it through a DVD queue back when most people had DVD queues.
DVD.com. Okay.
No, it's just Netflix.com then. I didn't have to go to a separate website.
I ordered two new DVDs then. Today.
Wow.
Which movies?
Terrence Malick's The Thin Red Line and My Man Godfrey.
Okay.
Which is Lubitsch.
All right.
Okay.
Maybe not Lubitsch. But yeah. I don't, you know, it's interesting that you say that because I think you're exactly right, Danielle. Like, the movie is, like, it is about can you, like, stop this, like, criminal mastermind, future Moriarty from, like, rising to control all crime and kill a whole, like, shitload of people. The movie is about that. It culminates in, like, the decision to figure out a desperate way to tie off the chain of events that leads to the creation of this monster. And yet, watching it the second time, I guess because I already knew that, I was able to just sort of set that aside. That's not the interesting part of the movie. But the interesting movie that's here is a harder one to describe and sell to people and to make them see when they're still trying to figure out what the ultimate arc of the story is going to be. Like, I think this is one of those movies that, like, plot serves poorly. In some ways, like, I think, sure. I wonder if Looper is a thing now.
And it presents as a puzzle box, right? Like, it presents as a puzzle box. So we're engineered as a viewer, you know, in a post, like, J.J. Abrams world. Like, there is a specific way that films are, and media can be built, where it's like, oh, this is how I'm supposed to watch this. I'm trying to see if I can get ahead of the movie to figure out where it's going. And it seems like, Rob, what you're suggesting is actually, like, once you've got the spoilers out of the way, you can actually focus on the movie that's there.
Yeah, like, there's this scene, because somebody was talking to me about how the film doesn't make sense. Like, the time travel paradoxes are completely unresolved. But, like, literally, there's a scene where Bruce Willis says straight up to his younger self, you know, don't think about the time travel shit. It just messes with your head. It's not worth it. You're not going to get any good, clear answers. Just go with it.
The Austin Powers moment that he has, yeah.
Yeah, and
I remember that.
And I think that actually is, like, I think that's as close as Rian Johnson gets to, like, coming out from behind the curtain in this movie and just being like, look, like, this movie operates with this conceit. It's not really about this, though. It's about, I think it's about how disappointing and small time the future was already starting to feel back in 2012, and where how disappointing and small time it appeared to be on a trajectory to becoming, right? So, like, this is a movie where early on they established, like, telekinesis exists. 10% of the population have telekinetic, like, psychic powers. They're useless. All they can do is, like, levitate like, quarters. That's it. Like, you can only, like, you can only lift, like, tiny lightweight things, and you can't even really move them. You can just, like, make them levitate, like, in your hand. That's
And it doesn't even get the guy dates. Isn't that the whole joke? That, like, oh, yeah, it doesn't really impress girls.
Right, nobody
anymore.
Likes it. Like, oh. Yeah, Emily Blunt's character talks about how what she would do is she wouldn't tell people she was telekinetic, and what she'd do is fuck with them by, like, holding their quarters down. They're trying to, like, show off what they could do. But it's also a movie where, like, even though the movie sort of built around this idea of a criminal mastermind, the way it kind of achieves this is, it, no wonder a criminal mastermind can, like, take off and succeed in this world, because most of the criminals you meet are, like, fucking incompetent douchebags, like, all of them. Yeah. Like, you know, the loopers, they're these, like, picked hitmen and all that, but they're not, like, they're guys who stand there waiting for a body to show up. They shoot it and then they, like, throw it down a well. That's their thing. The gun they have literally can't shoot for more than, like, a few yards. It's useless. The guy, good Jeff Daniels performance. Jeff Daniels, like, really, if you need somebody to be sort of a boomer asshole in your movie, who's, like, sort of snide and arrogant and, you know, no way less smart than he thinks he is, you get Jeff Daniels. But he's like this...
Oh, Newsroom.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah, Newsroom wasn't in on the joke, but unlike Looper or The Martian. But... this movie, like, he's the mob boss of this city. He's been sent from the future. But he was sent from the future just because they needed somebody to go back in time and run these fucking loopers. And so he's basically this cast-off who's, like, no use to the mob, like, in the future. So who do you send back to basically babysit a bunch of yokel fuck-ups? Well, it's Jeff Daniels. And he gets bored, and he takes over the city and becomes a mob boss, basically because he knows a little bit about what's going to happen because he's from the future, and he enforces his will through the Gatmen, those are the skilled killers, they're the gunmen, but they're all idiots too, and it's yeah. A weird thing, the degree to which this movie is all about, like, everyone in this movie is fronting, it's all self-presentation, it's all style, it's all, and this is what makes me think, like, that it's a really good Elmore Leonard movie, and also a Rian Johnson, like, genre subversion. It's a crime movie where everyone is, like, obsessed with the idea of being criminals, but they're all fucking bad at it. They're all fucking bad at it. And the thing that sets all this in motion is they're so bad at it that they accidentally fuck up the wrong person's life. And in the future, that person comes and, like, ruins theirs. That's kind of...
Well, and it's not so on the nose in, like, a Fargo sort of way, right? Where you have, like, a bunch of people want to be criminals or criminal fuck-ups who the point of it on its face, especially, like, in the... I mean, true in the movie and true in the TV series, but, like, it's meant to be overtly comedic, like, how bumbling these people are and what they get themselves into, whereas... it's, you know, Looper is a little more subtle about it, or it's more you're reading into that as a second or third reading of the film, as opposed to a Fargo where it's like, can you believe this shit? Like, it feels like Fargo is chuckling with you, whereas Looper, you kind of need to read between the lines a little bit on what its characters are.
I think Fargo, like Fargo is this entirely postmodern, like, look at how dumb everyone is and selfish and banal. Whereas, again, like, the Elmore Leonard thing is criminals are often, you know, like, people are career criminals who, like, choose, like, my job is going to be a stick-up man. That person is probably, in most cases, not going to be a scholar. That person is not going to have the best, like, impulse control. That's sort of the Elmore Leonard thesis, is, like, a lot of people get in trouble with the law. They're not crooks. Crooks are, you know, basic, like, career crooks in, like, the Leonardverse, most of them are pretty bad at their jobs. And, you know, they're going to end up shooting each other, getting arrested, or getting killed by the police. And what makes those universes kind of cool is that there's always that chance there's a few people who know what they're about in that world. And, like, seeing how the few people who have that modicum of self-awareness, like, interact with that world. And I think Looper kind of operates in that same tradition.
Yeah,
really enjoyable movie. I would say, like, worth revisiting if you remember it mostly as kind of a disappointing, sci-fi movie. And so, speaking of things that also might be surprisingly good, we're going to take a little break here, and you're going to hear an ad.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, we're back.
Are we?
We sure are.
I'm so glad.
My favorite is getting updates on, Twitter's a garbage fire, but what is it useful for? Hearing the responses from people about these ads, like a guy in the UK being like, every time Rob sets me up for an ad, I don't get an ad, and it makes me so excited because it means you cut to a break and then come back from it immediately, and it's just, thank you, algorithm. All praise the algorithm.
All right, so our last waypoint, I want you guys to get into, but then I'm going to have a lot of questions about, basically I need you all to explain horror to me, because in the last month I've sort of been drinking from the fire hose, but like this next waypoint is where I started to get really frustrated, because I started to be like, is this horror? Like, is this it? Like, is this what it's always been? Or is this like a subversion of the, like, is this a subversion or complication of the genre in a new format? I don't know, because I haven't seen any of the foundational texts. I haven't seen An Exorcist. I haven't seen The Shining. Haven't seen Halloween. Like, I just don't have, like, the context. And so
this is what we should stream this week. Is Rob watching all these horror movies?
No, because that would be humiliating. Like the part where I'm just like sort of like grabbing you by your arm and be like, I need to know right now, is this kid going to make it or not?
That's great TV, Rob.
Yeah.
Come on.
People don't need to see that. Anyway, Danielle, this is your waypoint for the week. You want to take us into The Haunting of Hill House.
Yes, I'll take you in. Although I need to take a deep breath as well, because watching this show is like processing trauma. That's how good it is and how intense it is. So I went into this zero expectations. I had seen a few tweets here and there. It's, you know, a couple of things here and there. But I was like, oh, they're remaking that again? There are so many remakes of this, the basic property, The Haunting or The Haunting of Hill House, or the general idea being there's a haunted house and people go there and it's scary and bad things happen and there are ghosts. There was a horrible 90s adaptation of this that I only remember because I think it was Catherine Zeta-Jones plays a bisexual woman. And at 15, I was like, whoa, that's a thing. Interesting. There's also Liam Neeson in that movie. And there's a giant hand. It's a whole thing. I'm not going to recommend that particular adaptation. However, it just, that was like what I was going into it thinking about. There's an older movie with the same name.
From 1968, I think it's with Vincent Price.
Yeah.
It's like one of his like more famous towards the end of when he was, I mean, he continued to be a character actor, but like when Vincent Price was like a home, you know, a household name, especially in genre films.
Yeah.
I watched it last October because my wife like had such fond memories about it. If you are only coming at it with like contemporary understandings of horror, it's slow in a way that may be frustrating, but it's probably interesting for historical context of just how they built tension and portrayed it in cinema, you know.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a very long time, so I a lot of it has a little bit not fresh in my mind. The original, sure. I think that was the original. I don't think there was a previous one, but yeah. So the 60s one, the 90s one, and then this TV show, I was like, oh, they remade it again. All right, cool. However, watched the first episode on a whim and I was clutching my dog. Like I was cuddling him. I usually cuddle with him. I was clutching him because of how effective it was. So what it is at its core is a mishmash of very, very good, genuinely like family drama or prestige drama about a family and domestic trauma and living through trauma and how people process trauma. And also a genuinely scary, ineffective horror show. It goes through sort of two timelines, one in the late 80s and one in the current day, following a family. So they move into this house in the 80s. Their whole shtick is they flip houses. They go to a house, they fix it up, they sell it for millions of dollars or whatever, a massive price. They go to this horrible haunted house, big, creepy, it looks gothic, it looks like what you think of when you think of a haunted house. Lots of rooms, lots of creepy stuff, there's ghosts everywhere, there's hauntings.
Statuary.
There's apparitions. Statuary. Yes, exactly. And you get to know the characters kind of bit by bit, episode by episode. Now, as Patrick has suggested, I've gone through the first three episodes at this point. I will continue watching it. However, it's a lot. So sorry, finishing the setup, it goes through this sort of two timelines. There are five children in the family and there's two parents. And it goes through both timelines of the, you know, back then, which is sometime in the 80s. It's not like said at this point, but there's like one of the little boy has like a Ninja Turtles pillow. So it's got to be like late 80s, generally around there.
Yep.
And sort of their adult selves and sort of how they have grown up, how they have dealt with their trauma or not dealt with their trauma, and what they're doing now. And there's a lot of ghosts. So the thing I want to say, like, top line about it is that it's really, really effectively shot. And actually, the editing is amazing. And you don't always notice the editing in a great movie or a great TV show. Even if you went to grad school for editing like me, you don't always, like, sit there and think, like, oh, this was a great cut. But it does beautiful things with cross-cutting, sort of one timeline to the next timeline very seamlessly. They do a ton of form cuts, which is just like, oh, you know, this one's eating an apple in this scene, and then somebody's eating an apple in the next scene, stuff like that. Like, just it just cuts on that sort of action really, really effectively and really nicely. There's a lot of great motifs. I've also heard, although I haven't necessarily noticed this yet, that there are, like, secret ghosts in a lot of shots.
I will send you a link.
Oh, please do, because I oh my god, that would be very
okay,
fun.
Okay, but they're cheating just a little bit, right? Because they underlight that house so aggressively that, like,
When I send you the links, like, there's no way for you, like, it's meant to be an Easter egg in the, like, someone on YouTube goes frame by frame through a shot to find, like, a head poking out of a, you know, a dark frame. But it is a movie that a show that, as Danielle is mentioning, like, that stuff shows the sort of, like, the level of attention to detail that is both in the shot composition, the Easter eggs for people that want to, like, go through and find that stuff, like, indicate parts of the history of the house and the people that have found themselves stuck there for whatever reason. Like, all those little touches, like, are imbued all over different parts of the show.
Yeah. And one thing it does so effectively that I think is beautiful, and it's sort of, I don't think of this as a subversion of the genre rather than a completely different lens on the genre. Like, it is shot with that attention to detail and edited and with that attention to detail, and the performances are incredible. So it really does feel like a genuinely lovingly rendered drama with these characters that are so rich and so complex, and the way they've dealt with the things that have happened to them in their lives are so interesting and realistic and layered and beautiful that it feels like, as opposed to some horror movies, which I still love, you have a bunch of archetypes running around. Like, in the couple of Purge movies that we've looked at thus far, it's you know, largely archetypes of people, or maybe not all the way stereotypes, but, you know,
by the time you get to election year, this type of person fuck is a bunch of stereotypes. Is it? All right, well, archetypes running around. That,
yeah, kind of. Yes, this feels like people. This feels like people who have realistically dealt with a lot of horrible shit and are trying to get through the day, and they are trying to get through some even more horrible shit and supernatural shit, or preternatural, as one of the characters prefers. Steve, the sort of oldest boy, prefers preternatural to supernatural.
Good term. I like it.
Yeah, it's very, very good and interesting. it's working on a lot of levels, textually and subtextually. I think there are a lot of things going on with the characters and their relationships that are beautiful and subtle. And man, it gets me. Like, that's the other thing. I'm watching this and I'm able to appreciate the craft of it. And I'm able to appreciate the writing and how it's working on all these levels. And it's also like, I'm a very emotional person, but I don't actually cry very much when I watch things. I'm usually like, I'm in it, I'm enjoying it, but I am on that other sort of level where I'm like, oh man, what a great edit. You know, I'm kind of always doing that. This second episode focuses on Shirley, who is, I think she's the oldest girl in the family. And she is a mortician. And the way she has processed all the trauma in her life, from the ghosts that haunted her literally as a kid to the ghosts that haunt her now, both literally and metaphorically, the business isn't doing great because she's so kind to people. She gives people a break on funerals, and she goes overboard with making people look beautiful at a funeral and does things like talks to the children if they're having trouble with dealing with a death in the family, because she needs to care. She is a caregiver. She is the kind of person who can only process things if she's taking care of other people, which that got me right there. There is also, and this is where I'm going to say content warning, like 1,000% for this episode. There are dead kittens in this episode, and it almost made me like sob. And my little cat was like right in front of me. Like, she comforts me when I get upset, and she was like coming up to me and like being very cute while I was watching this episode. And it was like, holy Jesus God. There is a scene where the parents are discussing how they handled Shirley sort of dealing with a death of a pet. And it's a beautiful scene and a subtle scene, because the mother in this world is sensitive to things like the supernatural. All the girls are sensitive to the supernatural. And one of the boys is certainly as well. And the way she kind of talks about how she fucked up, like she doesn't feel like she handled it well. She doesn't feel like she handled this discussion with her child well. And the father is kind of like, oh, I wish I was more of a part of this. I wish I, you know, could have given a little bit more advice on this, or this was more, you know, we made this decision in lockstep. It was this really honest and beautiful discussion about how they dealt with something. And they felt like it dealt with it poorly. That kind of really endeared me to these people as people who care about their children, who want to do a good job and talk about it and communicate about that. That sort of thing you don't see in every horror movie. You don't see parents discussing how they dealt with like a really, really sensitive issue with their child in the midst of, oh, and also in 2 seconds you might get a giant jump scare because something's going to come out of something's mouth, or something will become a ghost or something like
that. Don't go in a dumbwaiter.
Don't go in the dumbwaiter. Holy Jesus. So yeah, sorry, in the third episode that I want to shout out is the character of Theodora is sort of the most focused upon. She's a queer woman who is a child psychologist who, the way she's processed her trauma is to help children. And she has a sort of sixth sense in a way. She is able to kind of intuit people's feelings and intuit things in the environment. And that's used instead of in a cheesy way, where I think a lot of lesser movies or TV shows might just be like, oh, she can feel somebody's feeling. You know, she's doing the Deanna Troi of like, Captain, I sense fear. I sense they're not telling the truth. She's able to actually use this power in a way that she feels is both good and also compromised, because she also knows she lives in a world of horrible systems and corrupt systems, and she's doing her best, but she's so fucking smart, and she is so damaged, and she is dealing with it the best she can. So, my God, I am absolutely floored by this show, on both the craft level and on the just sort of gut level, emotional. I am both scared to death while I'm watching this and also like on the edge of crying every 5 minutes because of how well-drawn these characters are, of how real their pain feels in a lot of ways, and about how real like their processing of trauma feels. It feels like going through EMDR is what this show feels like going through that with a therapist or something. Like, the shit you see in that feels very close to kind of what the experience of watching this show is like. So yeah, I'm sorry, you have a lot of questions. I went on for a little while there.
I'll just echo sort of across-the-board praise for the show. It comes from writer-director Mike Flanagan, who has done a lot of really interesting horror genre work in the last 5 years or so. He's sort of like, who's the folks who got fired off of Solo? The
Oh.
They did the Lego Movie. Shoot, why am I forgetting that that duo? Anyway, they've done like 21 Jump Street. They did the Lego Movie. They had a way of like going into properties that they had no right to and turning them into something that was interesting and at times thoughtful and enjoyable. And so like Mike Flanagan has done this a number of times. Like the original Ouija film is complete garbage. It is unbelievable trash. And they made a second movie, Ouija 2, which like who would want to make that movie? Mike Flanagan would want to make that movie.
And one of the actresses was actually in that, I think. I think Kate Siegel, who plays Theodora, was actually in that as well. So it's,
correct. And she is the centerpiece of that film. Yeah. Like, he is someone that a lot of his work focuses on kids. He works really well with children and finds ways to make them fully fleshed out characters, as opposed to a lot of horror films that just take children and use them as, well, kids don't know what they're doing, so they're just going to, like, go into that basement so a ghost can pop out. And certainly stuff like that happens because it's a horror film. But, like, it's always treated very as though the kids are people too. And so, you know, Ouija 2 was a underrated film. I'm not going to say it's an all-time classic, but it's a good movie. Gerald's Game, which is one of Stephen King's all-time terrible books, somehow turns that into something interesting as well. In fact, the mother of in the past is the main character of Gerald's Game.
Gugino,
he's also adapting
Gugino, I think. Gugino?
Sure. I'm not familiar with the actress's name, so you're going to be closer than I am. He's also adapting Dr. Sleep. Again, famously, one of Stephen King's worst modern novels. And I'm confident he'll turn that into something interesting. Which is all to say, like, this, if you like Stephen King stories, I that's another angle I would look at this from. Like, Stephen King, the reason his stories are often terrifying have left to do with, like, the high concept or the jump scares as much as that stuff is building on strong character work, right? And so it's like Stephen King books work because you believe in the setting and the characters. The settings become characters. The people are believable. The reason his endings are so disappointing is because he builds up things in such a credible way that you're just so frustrated that he doesn't know how to finish them out. And Haunting of Hill House feels like Mike Flanagan's way of doing a television. Like Castle Rock, I think, is okay. There's a Stephen King TV series out there on Hulu. Haunting of Hill House blows it out of the water, like, because it better understands what is actually interesting about Stephen King as an author when he had at his best, when you read a book like It, or The Stand, or even Pet Sematary. I'm really enjoying it. You should be forewarned, Danielle, like, if you're already sobbing, I'm not past third episode, but I have heard episode 5 is a lot.
Yeah.
And so you might just want to be like, 5 and 4 is supposed to be very scary. 5 is apparently like emotional train wreck. And 6 might be the same way. So just like, if you're already like waterworking, like you might just want to be in a certain place when you like start turning the corner on these episodes. Yeah. And it's also, this feels like a more grounded version of Crimson Peak, which is also like a gothic melodrama. Yeah. Haunting of Hill House is a melodrama. Gothic horror tends to be melodramatic. And this feels a little more grounded, as much as like a horror piece of fiction is. And the last thing I'll say is that it lines up with a type of, I'm a big fan of like Friday Night Lights, Parenthood, like sappy family dramas are something that like have always been just like whatever. It's an itch I like to scratch. I've put off watching this Is Us show because I've heard it scratches a similar itch, but is like not nearly as good as Parenthood or Friday Night Lights was. And this show operates on that level for me, where it's like, it's a credible, interesting family drama that just so happens to have horror elements. And most horror tends to be the inverse, in which it's like horror is the centerpiece, and then there just happen to be characters in a plot so they can get to the other stuff. But this feels like the horror is a wrapper. The horror is like, it's not just thematic trapping, but the horror is like it's being used effectively around the characters, as opposed to the characters being a justification for like whatever horror story you wanted to tell. So anyway, I guess that we've left our cards on the table. Rob, have we answered anything? Where are you at? What was your reaction to this? Because it sounds like you were a little more, if not muted, confused on what to
take
away.
No, I think I like only watched the first episode, so I haven't really gotten into the meat of the show in a lot of ways.
The first three, I feel like, gives you an arc.
Yeah.
And that if you watch the three and it doesn't do anything for you, from what I understand, nothing is going to change going forward. It's only going to be more of
like
that.
I will say, I liked the first episode. I think for me, I think what did surprise me was the degree to which my understanding is, like, all horror movies and suspense movies, for the most part, operate to some degree on the level of metaphor, right? Like, the monster is not just the monster. The monster is also standing in for other things. You know, the conceit is can be analogized to a number of different different things that people experience or that are work in the world. I was surprised. So I was thinking of a different Parenthood movie, the Ron Howard movie with Steve Martin and Jason Robards from ages and ages ago. But it reminded me of a similar thing where it's a like multi-generational family drama in a lot of ways, trying to process like what happens when you all loved each other at one point. You're sort of this ideal American family, and then flash forward 20 years. Not everyone likes each other, or you all love each other and you want to care about each other, but like also you want to not have anything to do with each other. The problem of family members become estranged, and sometimes for good reasons, sometimes for petty ones. But like, what happens when there are people that like legitimately you don't want to answer the phone? You know you should, but you just don't. And maybe this person needs your help, but you're tapped out. You have no more help to offer.
Or you've done it so many times before that, like, part of the way, without getting into spoilers, of the plot beats of this show is like, your hope is, because it's a big family unit, that, well, I won't answer, but, you know, someone else will answer. And, like, they'll, like, I picked up the baton last time, like, hey, it's someone else's fucking turn to deal with this.
And I think what confused me here a little bit is that, for me, this feels entirely like a rapper is a good way to put it. Like, this one does feel like, is this a decent representation of what horror, like what classic horror tends to be? Because on the one hand, it's such a classic form. We bought a haunted fucking house and it's fucking cursed and terrible things happen. And we're all traumatized and horrified by what we've seen. But on another level, this is a story about, like, this could just as easily, like, if you just embrace the metaphor and you say, like, actually, nothing's haunted, there are no monsters, this is just a family haunted by loss and, you know, mental illness, you know, within the family and on the part of a parent, does this show substantially change? And I'm not sure it does, because it is such a family drama, like, down to its toes. That I'm sort of sitting here, like, a little bit, not weirded out, that's the wrong way to put it, but even though there's all these jump scares, there's a part of me that's watching it, and I'm like, yeah, okay, got it, monster, possession, scary thing dancing through the halls, okay, what's going on with Steven? Like, is he just an asshole, or is he, like, working through some stuff and he's just processing it badly? Like, is he really this insensitive, or is he just, like, relate to you badly? Like, that's the weird thing.
It's just Alan Wake.
Yeah, so, like, where I've come down with this movie is, like, when I watch this show, practically all I see is the metaphor. And, like, the horror of it begins to disappear for me entirely because, like, primarily it's about, you know, these daughters and sons processing what the collective trauma they share.
Well, this uniquely kind of got to me, I think, because it speaks so directly to why I like horror. Like, I've said before, I think it's the only honest genre, or only completely, fully honest genre of fiction, in that every human being, okay, I know it's maybe not a perfect argument, but it speaks to me, that every human being is afraid of death and afraid of loss and afraid of grief and has a very, very difficult time dealing with any of these things on a real level, on a day-to-day level. Because if you obsess about it all day, every day, you can't get through the day. You can't get through anything. These things become diseases. They become things that you can't keep you from functioning. So horror kind of reminds you of that and gives you that catharsis, I think. In this, it's working on that. It's working on both levels. It's working on that metaphorical level, but it's also working on that visceral level, that gut reaction. Like, yeah, it is that horrifying to have, like, a parent die, or it is that horrifying to have a pet die. It is that horrifying just be a flesh and blood being in this world that is going to die, that lives with the knowledge that you will become diseased and fall apart and die one day. That is utterly fucking horrific, no matter how much we dress it up or how much we like to pretend that our lives are normal in some fashion. Like, this is like family drama, ghost! And that works for me. It works for me so well, honestly.
The mashup works for me too. Yeah. Like, I totally see where Rob, you're coming from, where, like, especially someone that's like maybe not an appreciative horror, but just like a casual, like, dip in, dip out, like, you know, based on, you know, where the winds are going, if someone recommends it, or if we're doing a rewatch podcast, but it's not necessarily something where you're like seeking it out in the way that Danielle and I are like desperately looking for something like another hit of it. Like, just, I need something new. Like, I need to find some new way to get scared or like traumatized by some piece of horror. And I do think part of why I love this show is like the mashup isn't perfect, but it so effectively pulls off both of them that it does work for me, right? So, like, I think you're right that you could take out all of the monster elements and it would be a potentially interesting, like, family drama all on its own. Like, the characters are well realized enough, separate from the ghosts and what goes bump in the night, that there's a version of the show you could work out that, you know, you could see that functioning. And then the horror stuff, I think, is shot so effectively that it works on its own. And so mashing those things together is just like, oh, it's peanut butter and chocolate to me, baby. Like, I love cheesy, melodramatic family dramas. And then I love, like, horror. And also because it's very economical with the horror. Like, it's kind of in and out. It doesn't, like, when those moments come, you're, at least this has been my response, is you're like, ah, shit, okay, here we go. Whereas in most horror films, like, that's what you're there for the whole time, right? So there are moments where they can, like, credibly creep you out or make tense, but it has to work so hard to get to those moments, because that's what the whole 90 minutes is about. Whereas The Haunting of Hill House, like, has whole stretches, like 30 minutes of a show where it's just the family drama part. And then it's like cut two, and you're like, oh, shit, Flanagan, here we go. All right, okay, I'm gonna have to get another splash of a drink. It's fine. I thought I was done, but I didn't know they were going to do this now.
I think one thing that maybe does make this go down smoother is that I think if I were just watching the family drama version of this, I wouldn't, because, like, it is the intensity that the horror gives it that makes it, I think, more relatable. Like, this reminds me a little bit of a show that Netflix ran a couple years ago, Bloodlines, which was also a very good family drama, but it was all family drama. It was slow as hell, and I just fell off of it. Like, the performances were good. The family dynamics were, like, sharply drawn and thoughtful, but it was just missing something, because there just weren't enough people coming through the door with guns, basically. Or there weren't enough, like, you know, monsters, like, you know, reaching out for you while you slept.
The dad from Friday Night Lights being a badass just wasn't quite enough to carry that show along. Yeah. I was the same way.
Yeah, I think what gets me here a little bit is, so in the first episode, like, it opens on the most, one of, like, all the children have had different outcomes in their lives. They're all in different places, but, like, two of them have, like, never really overcome some of the issues they've been carrying since they were little kids, and those manifest in different ways. And it's too simple to reduce it down to, like, oh, one of them's, you know, got a narcotics addiction because he's torn up about his mom. But, like, clearly, like, one of these kids has become is struggling and losing to addiction. Another daughter is sort of still troubled by nightmares and, like, post-traumatic stress disorder stemming from stuff that happened in childhood. But the show opens on everyone's cells kind of being pinged by one of these siblings, and how everyone doesn't really want to answer that phone. And that first episode ends with, it's a horror beat, but it's a horror beat.
Oh,
but it's a horror
so
beat
good.
Built around what you always fear will happen if you don't pick up that phone. You know what I mean? Like, it is a horror beat that, like, and that moment is so much more real than, like, just the literal, like, oh, you didn't reach out to this person and the worst happened. Like, now how do you feel? Transforming that into a horror moment, in some ways, I think, makes it feel more real. It sort of pierces through, like, the armor a little more effectively. It becomes less of an intellectual, like, yeah, that could happen, and more of a, yeah, but how would it feel if that happened and yes. you right. clicked decline yes. earlier in the day.
Makes it, yeah,
it takes an emotion and like turns it into yeah. a physical object for you to look at.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'm also just not sure. Like, dude, it was a fucking grind. I was watching this at like 9:30 this morning and I was just like, I need a fucking beer. I am freaking out here. Like, I had the shades drawn and everything. That house sucks.
I've been doing the thing that I haven't done since I was a teenager. I remember doing this in Stir of Echoes in 2000. I was 16 years old.
Kevin Bacon classic,
genuinely scary ghost story. Yeah. I am watching scenes in this show like with my hands over my eyes. I am doing that thing. And I love horror. I live on horror. I live on the shocks. I live on the scares. I enjoy them so much. And that's how much this is getting to me. I think
Danielle,
because I'm
that
so
first
invested.
Shot in the... The first shot in the dumbbell thing.
That was a perfect one where I was just like, oh my God, I can't look. I have to look. Oh my God, I can't look. I'm like squeezing my dog. I'm watching this, like, again, cuddling him. I'm like squeezing him and he's just like, what is going on? And I'm like, don't look, Drake. Don't look. It's like.
My wife yells at me when I scream during football games for happy and sad reasons. Because usually we're watching that when my daughter's asleep. And so it always brings me great pleasure when I can turn the tables on her. And during this sequence in particular, with the dumbwaiter, there is a specific shot, the one that Danielle, you absolutely know which I'm talking about. It's yep. the first sort of reveal, yep. let's say.
Oh, my God.
And she just shrieked, like, as though she was auditioning for a horror film. Like, hey, can you scream? Like, just, like, show us if you're capable of screaming. It is, like, just... In no way did you mute yourself. You just, it came out in just like the loud, and I just, we had to pause. I was just like, Kat, I was just like, you yell at me all, so often to just keep my shit together during the football games. And like, what are you doing? It's 9 o'clock at night. Now she's really sleeping and you're screaming. And I was just, it brought
that's
me so
hilarious.
Much joy.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of remark, that's the kind of schadenfreude that can come back and haunt you later.
Oh,
it's true. That's true.
All right. I think that will do it for this week's episode. Where the hell did I put the outro notes? I've got too many fucking tabs open at this point. Yes, that'll do it for this episode of Waypoints. You can watch The Haunting of Hill House, based on Shirley Jackson's book, on Netflix.
Although I should say, like, because I've heard some people that are big fans of that original book. I have not read it myself. Adaptation would, in the loosest possible terms, from what I understand about what the that book is about, this is more like used as a starting off point as opposed to adapting. Yeah. So just and I'd be curious for folks that have read the book, like, do chime in, like, write into us and like let us know, or hit us up on the garbage fire that is Twitter, because I have heard from fans that are big fans of that book who really dislike the directions the show went in, and I wonder how much of that is tied to, you know, an appreciation of the original book itself.
All right. Our thanks to Tumelo for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight. You can find that at tumelomakes.bandcamp.com, and you can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people find you?
Danielle. At Patrick Klopik.
You can find me live tweeting my experience watching this show at Danielle R.I.
You totally have left Drake behind at Hill House. You'd have been like, that's not Drake. But it's
Peace.
Like, I think it is. And you're like, nope, I assure you it's not Drake. Car peels out.
The dogs weren't real.
Yeah.
There were no dogs.
I never had a dog. What are you talking about?
Wash my hands.
All right, that'll do it for Waypoints. Hope you've enjoyed the break. We'll be back real soon with, I don't know what our schedule looks like this week. Because we are going to be doing a marathon stream starting on Thursday at noon, and run our part of the 72 hours is going to run through Friday night at midnight. We're going to be doing this for the Florence Project, which you can learn more about at FERP. Sorry, that's not helpful. You have to imagine it. You have to imagine it being FIRRP.org.
Love to edit this part out because it's disrespectful, but it's extremely funny.
So you can learn more at ferp.org.
Rob, you keep doing it.
I can't help it at this point. I just have to read that URL. FIRRP.org. That's the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project. They give legal aid services to detainees in Arizona. And we did an interview with Amalia Luxardo from the Florence Project the other day. You can listen to that at the tail end of our most recent episode of Waypoint Radio. But we're going to be kicking off a charity marathon stream for the Florence Project on Thursday at noon, which you can, you know, watch over at twitch.tv/waypoint. And we're going to be doing it for 36 hours, and then we're going to kick it over to our community, who are going to be seeing out the rest of the 72. We're still working out like what our overall programming schedule is going to look like. I'm pretty sure at least we're going to be doing some XCOM and Tactical Tuesday type stuff, hopefully early, because I'm not letting Austin anywhere near that save, given Austin's proclivities. Once we are like 12 hours into this thing, I don't want Austin to be near our precious soldiers.
Wow.
We're gonna do a lot of things. I think we're gonna do some Natalie wants to do some blackout. Breakfast and blackout, which it's a good name, but also I want to play some Dead Cells. For sure we'll do some horror games. Figuring that stuff out. But if people have suggestions or things you guys everyone would want us to do, you know, hit us up because we're still kind of ironing out what exactly that's all about.
And we may have another podcast for you this week. We might also just be recording a couple podcasts live during the stream. We're still sort of working out what our schedule is going to be. It's a little hectic because we are all gathering in New York. We're all migrating for the season to stream together in New York. So hope you'll join us again. But until then, do not give in to astonishment.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.